Good morning. And as you can see, we only have one chair at council table. That is not to exclude anybody. It's just to inject a little bit of social distancing into the seating. Council are welcome to sit in the bench in the back and, of course, in the gallery as well. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is the second of our three oral arguments that we're hearing this morning. This case is A220144 in the matter of the trust of Robert W. Moreland, also known as Robert William Moreland. And counsel, you look like you are getting settled in here. So we'll get started in just a moment. I just want to give you a few guidelines about the timing of your arguments and where to stand. So as you both know, counsel for appellant will have 15 minutes for argument, counsel for respondent will have 15 minutes, and then counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. You are welcome to make your arguments either from the microphones that are closest to counsel table or from the microphone in the center here. The microphone in the center is where you will find the clock and the lights indicating how much time you have. So just keep that in mind as you're deciding where to present your arguments this morning. Those are all the remarks I have. We will go ahead and get started. Counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Morning, counsel. May it please the court. My name is Robert Bauer. I represent the appellant, Dean Moreland. This case is about a valid trust that no one disputes was properly executed in 2002, and then we have two amendments to this trust. So the 2002 trust, witnessed and notarized, as you should do and should be required to do, it's drafted by a lawyer, and it does say that it can be amended by an instrument, and it references an instrument in writing signed by the grantor and delivered to the trustee. So that's the first inquiry, is what is an instrument? What are we required to do? Is it just put something in writing? If we look at the addendum at page 52, the First Amendment is written by the respondent for his aging father. It's back in 2016. No original has ever been produced. We have handwriting, we have dashed lines, we have circles, we have underlines. This is hardly an instrument. This is not witnessed, not notarized. It's just signed. We don't know if it's a draft. We don't know if it's final form. Were the notations added after the fact? Were they added before? None of this was provided. We don't have the original, so we don't know what was really produced. So again, not witnessed and notarized, and the trial court did not make...
Counsel, are you arguing that in order for a document to be an instrument, it must be witnessed and notarized?
Yes.
And because what is the legal basis for your argument?
More formality. If the original trust in 2002 had just said it can be signed and delivered to the trustee, it's more formal. What is an instrument? I guess that's a question of law for the court. I would argue an instrument is something more than just a handwritten note with scratches on it. We don't know what this is. We don't have the original. So the 2016 amendment, again, drafted by the respondent for the benefit of his aging father, changing the percentages to his benefit, it's more formality. What is required? The 2002 trust says it must be an instrument. And as a matter of law, I would submit to the court that is something more than just one page, handwritten signature, not witnessed, not notarized.
Go ahead.
The trust document itself doesn't define the term instrument. So what legal authority would you cite us to support your view that an instrument is a document that must be signed and notarized, or witnessed and notarized?
The trust code now requires an original trust, the first time you do a trust, to be witnessed and notarized. It didn't at the time in 2002, so the grantor went above and beyond. He went to a lawyer, he had it witnessed and notarized. The current law would require the first time you do a trust to be witnessed and notarized. A trust is designed to be more informal, but again,
but the current law doesn't require an amendment to be witnessed and notarized.
It does not. I will concede that. It does not.
Okay.
So then we look at
making an argument just based on
the
principle of formality.
The language of the 2002 trust required an instrument, which is something more. The grantor went above and beyond. He went to a lawyer. He had the trust witnessed and notarized. He had Schedule A witnessed and notarized with the percentages. We now have, at Addendum 52, a typewritten trust amendment with circles, dashes, hardly read the signature of the grantor, not witness and notarized. That's the problem when you have lack of formalities. You have a trust instrument that is vague and ambiguous. And the trial court improperly found that the First Amendment was valid. But even more troubling is the Second Amendment. Second Amendment drafted in 2019, again by the respondent for his aging father who was blind. Again, no original has ever been produced. And the trial court found that given the complexity, so in the addendum at 53 and 54 is the Second Amendment. So in this Second Amendment, the respondent now is to get 94%, and the other five siblings or six siblings get 1% or $5,000. And we have this clause that the above percentages will only be paid out if they start acting light, not like light family. So even the respondent acknowledged in his testimony at the transcript of page 15, lines 20 to 25, that his percentage might go down as well, that he might not get the 94% if the siblings are not acting like family. So the trial court initially found that the First Amendment, given the complexity of the family dynamic, was incapable to be interpreted, that it would be impossible for the court to unambiguously interpret. It was too subjective to be enforceable, and initially found the entire Second Amendment to be invalid on this basis. So again, what is acting like family supposed to mean? And again, this is where the respondent is now getting 94% of the estate, and he drafted it. So again, not witnessed, not notarized, and if you compare the signatures, again, we do not have an original. If you compare the signatures on Addendum 54 to the signature on Addendum 52, I mean, they're hardly, we didn't have a handwriting expert, but they're hardly legible on the First Amendment, and the Second Amendment is legible, and he's blind at this time.
Can I ask you, Mr. Bauer, because I didn't pick this up from your brief, but given your comments today, you're not, I understand your arguments about the failure to witness and notarize, but you're not arguing that these amendments are not true and actual amendments, are you? I mean, you're not making an argument that they are somehow phony or, doesn't reflect the Mr. Moreland's signature, that type of argument.
Well, the only one who could provide testimony was the respondent who drafted them and was present when his father witnessed them. So that's the only testimony we have.
But my point is you're not making that argument that they are invalid on that ground. I didn't pick that up from the things you raised in your brief.
Not on that ground. On first the First Amendment, I'm arguing, again, we don't have the original.
Right.
We have scratches. We have handwritings. We have circles. What is that? Is that truly a trust amendment? I agree, it's written, it's signed, but again, we have dash lines, we have circles. Is this the final draft? What is it? And I think the trial court trying to ascertain the intent of the grantor, what is it? We've got drafts, we've got circles, we've got extra lines. Was this the final version? Was he going to edit it again? We don't know. And then we get the Second Amendment that's completely ambiguous. The trial court acknowledges it's ambiguous, but yet when a motion for amended findings is made, they say, well, let's strike that penalty provision. And how do you, so ascertaining the grantor's intent, what was the grantor's intent? To have the penalty provision or to not have the penalty provision? And is it ambiguous? The trial court found that it was incapable of being implemented, unable to determine the grantor's intent, completely subjective. It was up to the respondent to determine if they're acting like family to him again. And again, as he testified, that could mean his percentage would not be paid out. It's completely ambiguous. But then the trial court goes a step further and says, well, we'll strike the penalty provision. Now it's valid. Well, there's no case law that says you can strike a provision of a trust amendment, assuming it's valid, to make it unambiguous. So the trial court goes above and beyond and say, well, I'm going to make a finding that the penalty provision should be stricken, and now it's unambiguous. Well, you have already made a finding before that it was ambiguous, incapable of being implemented, completely subjective, and now just by striking a paragraph, you find it, well, it's not ambiguous anymore. The problem with that argument or that finding by the trial court is that under Minnesota Statute 501C0415, the only time you can reform a trust instrument or a trust amendment is if there is a mistake of fact or law. That's clear under the law. The trial court made no finding that there was a mistake of fact or law. That's critical, because you can't reform something unless there is a mistake of fact or law.
Didn't the district court implicitly find that there was a mistake of fact in that it was impossible to conform to the requirements as of the trust, that Second Amendment as written?
Well, inherently, the trial court said it was ambiguous, incapable of being implemented, completely subjective to the respondent. So I don't know that that's a mistake of fact or law by the grantor.
What is a mistake of fact?
A mistake of fact would probably be that you are writing someone out because you thought that they were deceased and they weren't. That would be a mistake of fact. I'm not providing for my son Dean because he's deceased when in fact he's not. That would be a mistake of fact.
And is it your position that in order to reform a mistake in accordance with 501C0415, a district court has to make an explicit fact finding that there's clear and convincing evidence of the settler's intent, and there's either a mistake of fact or a mistake of law?
I'm just going by what the statute says. The statute says,
I've got the statute. Yep. I'm asking if the district court needs to make a specific factual finding in its findings of fact or conclusions of law that there was, in fact, a mistake of fact or a mistake of law.
I believe that would be the case. You, in order to reform, you have to say that there is a mistake of fact or law and identify what that mistake is.
And it's not good enough, according to your interpretation of the statute, for a district court judge to make a finding that the language is ambiguous or it's not capable of being executed as written.
Those findings are in both orders, that it's ambiguous, incapable of being implemented, completely subjective. It's in both orders from the district court.
Counsel, though, wasn't the district court focused on the penalty provision, not the whole Second Amendment, when it said it was ambiguous?
That's the question of what is the grantor's intent. Was the grantor's intent to have the penalty provision remain in place and to have someone make a determination as to whether they're acting like family again? Or is it pay that out and ignore the penalty provision? Which part of the trust amendment, if we're trying to determine the grantor's intent, are we to believe was his intent? The court found in both orders that it was ambiguous, completely subjective, incapable of being implemented. And so the court substituted its own judgment for that of the grantor and said, I'll just strike the penalty provision. Now it's not ambiguous.
So given that the penalty provision is ambiguous, I think everyone, both parties agree with that point. Why wasn't it proper for the district court to strike that and reform the Second Amendment as, you know, given that the, wasn't the ambiguous, inclusion of the ambiguous language really a mistake of law, since the grantor was mistaken about the legal effect of that language, whether it could be implemented or not?
I was unable to find any case that says the court can strike a provision of a trust or a trust amendment in order to make it unambiguous. There's no authority for that.
So well, I don't think it has to be unambiguous to be reformed. Under the statute, it says the court may reform the terms of a trust even if unambiguous. So that suggests the court can reform a trust that is ambiguous.
I would respectfully disagree that when the court makes a finding in both of its orders that the trust is ambiguous, completely subjective, incapable of being implemented, that that throws out the entire Second Amendment, that you can't just cherry pick and say, well, I'm going to determine what the grantor's intent was. The grantor's intent was they get the percentage, not just the $5,000. You know, it's we're relying on what respondent has told us. And keep in mind, respondent was removed as trustee. He was not responsive to his siblings' request to provide information, wouldn't provide copies of the trust and trust amendments. We still don't have the originals. We have no idea where these are. So again, we are left with the respondent, who's the one benefiting from the amendment, his sole testimony to say this is what my dad wanted. So I would respectfully request that the court reverse the district court on both grounds, that the First Amendment, again, we have no idea if this is the final version or a draft, and the Second Amendment as being ambiguous, as the trial court found. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bauer. You'll have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Kemp. I, along with Paul Funke, represent the respondent, Robert Moreland. There are two questions before the court today. Should the district court's decision be affirmed as to the grantor's intent in this first trust, the First Amendment, and the Second Amendment? And second, whether there's any requirement in law that the amendments to a trust be witnessed and notarized? Because the district court correctly determined both issues, its order should be affirmed. And I want to start where courts have to start when they're construing a trust amendment, which is with the grantor's intent. There's several questions that came up in arguments just a few minutes ago that I want to address. The first one, Judge Halbrooks asked whether there is any argument that these amendments were phony, fraudulent, forgeries. And there's no argument on appeal that they were. There's constant references to respondent being the only person who was around the decedent who might know. And we can't do anything about the fact that petitioner essentially abandoned his father 2 decades before and now shows up claiming unfairness because he didn't know his father's physical or mental capacity. That argument's not before the court. And the court should reject any implication that there needs to be some sort of heightened burden to prove an amendment to a trust based on the fact that the one person who stood by the decedent was the only person who's living to testify about these trusts. The district court found clearly that there were no issues of mental capacity, duress, or fraud. And this court has no reason to doubt that. So let's look then at the second question that was posed. It is very true that there is a stark disparity between what was granted to the trustee at the time, respondent Robert Moreland, and his siblings. That Second Amendment gave 94% of the estate to Robert Moreland, the one who had stood by his father, and divided up 6% to the others. The question that the court had to ask below was whether, one, this stark disparity was clearly intended, and two, did it conform to the evidence? And the answer is yes to both of those questions. Looking back even at the 2002 amendment, you can see that the decedent, the grantor in this case, divided his estate unequally between his children from the very beginning. The First Amendment, which was executed more than 15 years later, extended that disparity. And the Second Amendment, the one that was at issue in the trial court, extended it still further. But that was clear. So is there any evidence to support why this would conform with the grantor's intent? Well, there's a couple things that we heard from testimony and that the trial court found. For instance, a father distributing his estate among his children might well distribute based on need. Petitioner was a NASA engineer. He was literally a rocket scientist, and the respondent was a handyman living in his father's basement. We heard from testimony that the grantor himself had made loans to respondent, encouraged petitioner and other siblings to do the same. And that tells us that there is testimony supporting the grantor's intent that he had a child who might have greater need of his estate than the others. What about his desires, too? The grantor's desires come into play. Judge, you look like you had a question for me.
Well, I'd like to jump to the question of the Reformation and whether that was done consistent with Minnesota Statute 501c.0415. And, of course, I'm talking about the Reformation of the Second Amendment.
You are, Your Honor. And let me back up that question for a minute, because appellant has overly narrowed it. 501c.0202, subdivision 4, says what the court can do, what the subject matter jurisdiction can be. It lists construe, interpret, reform, or deviate from the plain terms. Interestingly, it does not say modify. And if the court looks back just a couple of subdivisions in the statute that you just cited, instead of 0415, let's look at 0412, which allows a court to modify a word absent from that statute I just listed, the terms of a trust. The reformation in 0415 is another way that the terms of trust can be, I'm going to use an umbrella term, changed to mean all of these different terms. The court, in construing the grantor's intent, can change it by reforming it. And looking, Your Honor, at 0415, it's reforming it. We define that as correcting a mistake of fact or law. In other words, the grantor's intent is clear, but needs to be, the terms of the trust need to be changed to conform to the grantor's intent. And we can distinguish that from a modification, which deals with the administration, whether the terms laid out in the trust can be properly administered, or whether it will be impossible, subjective, wasteful, and those other things. So getting to what I think, well, I won't put words in your mouth. Your question, Your Honor.
So my question for you is, the district court made clear that it was reforming the amendment, and it cited to the statute, but it didn't expressly state that it found a specific mistake of fact or law. In your view, is there a mistake or fact or law that supports the Reformation, and if so, what is that?
Yes, there is, and there does not need to be. But to answer your question, what is the mistake here? It is a mistake of law. A mistake of law in this case is a question of whether the grantor has put terms into this document that he believed would be enforceable that as a matter of law or not. In other words, he had made a mistake as to the legal effect of a term that he put into the document. That term is the penalty provision. The court determined that penalty provision is unenforceable. And whether we agreed or not, it's certainly a bad idea. We saw no reason to challenge it, and we don't do so here. So the court's decision there does implicitly say that this is a mistake of law. It doesn't specifically say mistake of law, but it very clearly lays out the fact that this provision, this penalty provision, is not an enforceable provision, lays out the reasons for it. And because of that, it is reasonable to look at 0415 and say that this is a reformation. But the second part of the answer to that question is it doesn't have to be, because a modification is perfectly justified too. And whether the court used the term reformation when it meant modification, we look at the language that was cited over and over by appellant himself that the court kept coming back to. This will be impossible to administer. It's too subjective. There's no way that the trustee can reasonably understand and interpret this intent. Now, that's not a reformation under 0415. That's a modification under 0412. But either one of them are allowed by statute. Either one of them are supported, and either one of them would mean that the district court properly struck that penalty provision and interpreted the rest of the document according to the grantor's intent.
So, counsel, turning to 501C.0412, which deals with modification, what language are you focusing on there that you think would authorize the district court to modify the trust?
Your Honor, in this case, the modification is allowed if there are unanticipated circumstances, we're not arguing that, or inability to administer the trust effectively. You can look at subdivision B. The court may modify the administrative terms of the trust if continuation of the trust on its existing terms would be impractical or wasteful or impair the trust administration. And that's what the court was saying when it said that all this language cited by the appellant, that this penalty provision is just too subjective. It would be impossible to administer. The court even used the word administer. And so in this case, looking at 0412, you can see that that also is a reason to strike this penalty provision. Now, importantly, this can only be done if it doesn't do violence to the grantor's intent. And this is a point brought up by Mr. Bauer, but I think one brought up incorrectly. In this case, there is a penalty provision. But if you look back at the original trust and at the First Amendment to the trust, each one of these lays out unequal percentages by which the beneficiaries will distribute, or receive, I should say, the estate. For the first time in that Second Amendment is when this penalty provision is put in. The testimony at trial was that this family had fractured decades before and had grown increasingly estranged. The court noted the family dynamic that was really worsened by this provision. But you can completely understand a man looking at the end of his life and his family having fractured, that one of his last wishes was that his family start acting like family again. It may not be enforceable. In fact, we're not arguing that it is. But that new provision can be severed without doing violence to the grantor's intent of distributing his estate in accordance with his wishes. And that's exactly what the district court did. So I want to address a couple of points that were made by appellant, because I think a few of them are important. One of them, Mr. Bauer said that there is, I think I wrote this down correctly, no case law that allows a court to strike a provision in a trust to make it unambiguous. I'd like to give four examples. And all of them can be found on pages 28 to 29 of appellant's brief. In Re Hart's Estate, the Bemis case, Arneson v. Arneson, Mary O. Foley Trust. In each of those cases, we've cited to the courts being able to strike out a provision, to sever, to segregate unenforceable provisions from enforceable provisions.
Counsel, do those cases apply given that they predate the adoption of the Section 501(c) by the legislature?
They absolutely do, Your Honor, because 501(c) was a recodification of 501(b.16), 501(c.0202) subdivision 4, or number 4, I should say, excuse me, is essentially lifted word for word from 501(b). That authorizes a deviation from the, both of those authorize a deviation from those terms. They absolutely apply. And in this case, they should be applied, and the district court correctly did so. There's another question that came up, though, that was important as well. Now, in this case, Mr. Bauer said, current law requires trust to be witnessed and notarized, but never cites to anything. There's no provision, none, no provision anywhere that requires a trust to be notarized. Look through all of the briefs. It's not there. It's not in case law. It's not in statute. And it's not required by the trust itself. The idea that a trust itself or a trust amendment has to be notarized is completely made up, let alone witnessed. It's just not there. So then they turn to the question of, well, this is an instrument. As if an instrument were a term of art defined in the statute or defined in the trust itself. Now, trust instrument is a defined term. The question is, did the grantor in this case want the term instrument, as he used it in that trust, to mean something that is witnessed and notarized? Judge, you asked what the legal basis was, and if you notice, the question wasn't answered. There is no legal basis to decide that the grantor decided that the term instrument needed to have these heightened formalities. It simply doesn't exist. The district court, Your Honors, properly determined the intent of the grantor, properly determined that striking this penalty provision was allowed under law and would not do violence to the intent of the grantor. And that decision should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bauer, you will have 5 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you. May it please the court. Just a couple clarifications. Under current law, when you make a trust for the first time, it must be witnessed and notarized. So that, just for clarity, it must be witnessed and notarized under current law. At the time the respondent did the 2002 trust, that was not a requirement. As to the cases, the four cases that he cited, saying that the trial court has the ability to amend that or reform, again, those are all cases cited prior to the enactment of 501(c). So the critical aspect of 501(c.0415) is that the court may reform, okay? So like, counsel wants to twist what the district court did, but at addendum 38, in the second last paragraph, the court clearly is reforming. The court says, in reforming the Second Amendment to the trust, specifically saying that the court is reforming the trust. If the court is going to reform the trust under Minnesota Statute 501(c.0415), if there must be clear and convincing evidence of what the grantor's intention was, which there was none, and that the terms of the trust were affected by a mistake of law or fact. The trial court made no finding that there was a mistake of law or fact. That is required under the statute. And again, what is the grantor's intent? We have the trial court again saying it's incapable of being implemented. What could be the grantor's intent? As I indicated before, is it the grantor's intent was specifically that everyone act like family? Or was the grantor's intent that, nah, you don't get the 5,000, you get the 1%?
Counsel, didn't the district court make findings about the grantor's intent? You know, if you look at page 38 of the addendum, the district court is specifically discussing the grantor's intent and the evidence before the court.
The district court was discussing that the family was fractured, as a result of the divorce many years ago. But that might explain why the percentages back in 2002 were as they were. Again, we look at the 2016 amendment that is, again, we don't know if that's a draft. We don't know if that's a final version. The trial court made no findings as to that first amendment. And then we get to the second amendment. What is the grantor's intent? We don't know. The court is striking a provision in order to find that a document is unambiguous, and now I can interpret the intent. If I strike that one clause, now I can find out what the grantor really wanted.
Well, don't the documents on their face reflect an intent for, as the district court found, that to reduce the percentage distribution of the trust to the children that he hadn't had contact with for almost 19 years?
I don't think the testimony was that he had had contact with them. It's that they had not been...
Had person face-to-face,
face-to-face
contact,
right,
yes.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
So, yes, and the family scattered throughout the country, so that possibly it's attainable. I don't know the other respondents. My client lives in Texas. To ascertain the grantor's intent, again, the respondent wrote this. The grantor was blind, okay? He claims to have read it to him.
Well, does the record reflect that he was 100% blind? I thought the record reflected that he was blind in one eye.
At the time that he did the 2002 trust, he was blind in one eye. At the time he did the Second Amendment in 2019, he was totally blind. I believe that's the record.
Okay, thank you for the clarification.
So he did have to read it to him. And again, if that's the grantor's intent, they want to act like family, or is it that they get the percentages? The trial court's making things up politely to strike this, to say this is now what I think can be the grantor's intent if I strike this one clause. But again, you're reforming. The district court specifically said, I'm reforming the trust, the 2019 amendment. And in order to reform, there has to be a specific finding that there was a mistake of law or fact, and there is none. The district court erred in that matter. As a matter of law, the court found that it was ambiguous, incapable of being implemented, completely subjective, and again, even the respondent testified that his percentage might go down, might not get the 94%. So what are we to do? We have an ambiguous Second Amendment. It should be stricken in its entirety. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you both for your very helpful arguments.